From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Faith means something different to everyone.
So many of us are shaped by the invisible, however you want to define it.
Actor Stephen Tobolowsky chose to write his memoir by describing the evolution of his relationship with God. We'll talk to him later this hour after we look for God in American politics, look for some witches in Atlanta, and maybe Satan in a Cobb County school. That's all ahead, but first, Friday we inspired some grammar vigilanteism in the break room.
Use a period for crying out loud. Ooh,
that is a frustrated Tamika DePriest, marketing director for Emory University. Here are your first thoughts and first gripes.
Hi, my name is Mary. I'm calling from Macon, Georgia, with my pet peeve word, impactful. Sounds like an asteroid catastrophe. I see it everywhere now, and it drives me nuts.
Hi, my name is David. I'm from Cartersville. One thing that gets me is when people say they could care less when they're saying they don't care. If you could care less, that means you care about it a little bit, but you could care a little bit less.
Oh, my God, David, that drives me crazy. Also, I can't. Oh, it drives me crazy. Anyway, we care what you think. You can call us like David did and also Mary at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Religious freedom is protected by the U.S. Constitution. It's the very First Amendment. And yet one particular religious sect has dominated our politics and shaped our nation's laws, Protestant Christianity. How this happened is the subject of a new book by Francis Fitzgerald, The Evangelicals. It's about the rise and influence of America's largest religious movement. And Francis Fitzgerald joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you go back to the beginning of the association between Protestant Christianity or evangelicalism and politics. But when did that really begin? Was there a time when religion was truly divorced from politics in this nation?
I don't think there was, no. It seemed certainly just after the revivals of the Great Awakenings, which, you know, turned people into evangelicals. Evangelicals were the leaders of all the reform movements, reforming criminal justice system, care for the indigent. They created the public education system in the United States, and the Northerners were largely abolitionists.
Now, are you talking about the First Great Awakening going back to like the 1730?
No, well, this was after the Revolution. During the First Great Awakening, it was rather more intra-religious politics. These evangelical preachers were very anti-establishment in terms of their churches, and they posed sort of direct threats to the subsidies that went from the states to the churches at that time.
So I want to fast forward quite a bit, a couple hundred years or so, to the time when people start thinking about the connection between evangelicals and politics. We start to think almost immediately of this guy.
Light as a feather, stiff as a oar. Light as a feather, stiff as a
oar. Nope, that's not it. This would be the voice of Billy Graham. Okay, he doesn't have it.
Faith is supposed to give you doubt.
That's wrong also. We start to think almost immediately of Billy Graham and Pat Robertson. How did, and it appears from your book at least, that this was strategic on the part of some leaders in the church to make a very intentional connection with politics. Why?
Well, I don't think that it ever had ever really stopped. I mean, you know, there was a moment when, after the great divide between the liberal churches and fundamentalist churches, the fundamentalists, you know, seemed to disappear. But in fact, they didn't at all. They were building their own churches, their own fiefdoms, and a lot of them were very much involved in politics. I mean, the man who really brought evangelical or fundamentalism rather, to the South, was very much involved with both of Franklin Roosevelt and his opponent. So I think it's something that's never really stopped. I mean, from time to time, there are not a lot of people who are concerned about politics as religious people. And that did last for quite some time. But then a movement arises, and the movement was really Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson with the Christian Right. It was not Billy Graham who had his own politics, and but he didn't lead a popular movement.
Well, let's hear Pat Robertson here.
There developed in Watergate, in our audience, and in the nation, a very serious distrust of government, and I don't think it's been restored yet. We don't have the bright, shiny-eyed idealism and patriotism there once was. There's a cynicism that is set in about government, and I think that it came out of that period.
So what was Pat Robertson's strategy? How did he go about aligning himself with politicians and wielding influence?
Well, extraordinary. I mean, he first of all created an enormous empire of television and radio and so forth, and he was very innovative in communications. He then ran for president in 1988. That was really the first time people outside his own audiences had heard of him. He didn't get all that far, but after that, he started something called the Christian Coalition, which was probably the most effective religious group that evangelical group in politics at the time.
How was that different, the Christian Coalition of Pat Robertson, how was that different from the Moral Majority, which was a political organization founded by Jerry Falwell?
Well, they both had pretty much the same aims. It was just that the Christian Coalition was better led. It was more strategic. Jerry Falwell was a separatist fundamentalist, and he found it hard to attract people who were of other faiths, except for some Southern Baptists. But Pat Robertson, who was charismatic, but who had this enormous television show, was able to attract people of all kinds of different evangelical denominations.
So let me play you this comment from Robert Jones. He is part of an organization that studies religion, and his book was called The End of White Christian America. Here's what he had to say.
I think that is the key to really understanding this cultural shift. I mean, from the beginning of the country, I think it's important to remember the power not just that white Christianity had, but white Protestant Christianity had. If you look at the early, constitutional Congress and members of Congress early in the country, all the way through really the middle of the 20th century, it was really white Protestants
right.
That had power in the country. There's this great line in one of the books as I was doing research by historians said, if you were in charge of something big and important all the way up through the middle of the 20th century, chances are you were white, male, and Protestant.
So was this just a function of the fact that if you were white, male, and Christian, you were automatically going to, you were dominant in the United States, or was there something else at play here?
Well, I mean, he doesn't make a distinction between Protestant, liberal Protestants and evangelical Protestants. And I don't think there was much of one until the fundamentalist, modernist clash around the First World War. But I think that to a great degree the movement that Falwell and Robertson started was was a reaction to the new pluralism, to the fact that Catholics, Jews, people of no faith, whatever, were moving into power, taking their place in the whole spectrum of U.S. Government and business, and changing the laws, because the laws had been made by Protestants, and they tended to reflect their particular biases, and so these were to be changed to make the state more neutral, as opposed to, being essentially a work of the Protestants.
So, all right. So we get to this point in which evangelicals, specifically evangelicals in the Christian religion, had already established for hundreds of years this relationship with politics and this relationship with politician. So let's move forward to 2017. How much of our laws are based on evangelical beliefs? How much is evangelical belief part of our everyday life and how we go about proceeding?
Well, that's a very good question, because, it's an unstable answer to it, because the laws have been changing, particularly laws related to sexuality and privacy and religious freedom, whatever that is actually means, and when that it's not entirely clear. But, I'd say until the 1940s that the great bulk of laws which had to do with morals was absolutely evangelical Protestant.
So you're saying most of the laws we have today that have to do with governing behaviors are based on the evangelical philosophy?
Well, yes, but as I say, it's been changing because they've had to become more neutral as a result of the recognition of large amounts of Catholics,
right,
and so on.
And, of course, we've talked before in the show about the fact that the numbers of evangelical Christians have been dwindling, especially here in Georgia and the rest of the South. Thank you so much to Frances Fitzgerald. She's author of The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America. She'll speak at the Atlanta History Center at 8 on Wednesday. Frances, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, actor Stephen Tobolowsky talks about his adventures with God. But first, practical magic at Atlanta's only store for witchcraft. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're interested in the arcane and the occult, there's a new store that caters to you. ATL Craft opened last month. It offers spell kits, sage, and yes, even small cauldrons to suit witches in small apartments. GPB intern Olivia Reingold stopped by the shop last week to talk with the owner.
Hi, my name is Haley Murphy, also known as Witch Mama. I am the owner of ATL Craft, and I'm going to take you on a tour. We have pretty much anything you would need for spell work. We have feathers, shells, wands, nails, railroad spikes. I have rituals that I do every morning. Sometimes I use a bell, sometimes I'll clap, sometimes I'll tap my third eye. and I light my incense and I light my candles by saying a prayer. Great Spirit, thank you for everything you've given us, the clothes on our back, the food in our belly, the roof over our head. I know that it could be scary, especially being in the South. Coming out as like a witch to everyone and being open about it and creating a space for it. But I didn't want to waste any time. I was like, I'm ready. Like, I'm ready to do this.
My name is Jenny O'Shea. I'm a frequent customer here, but today I'm going to be reading some tarot. I usually start with shuffling my cards. I like to refresh in the deck before I start any readings.
Oh. Okay. Okay, so you've got the Knight of Wands in your past. The Wands.
I have been reading tarot since I was first exposed to tarot and witchcraft when I was about 13 or 14. And so moving to Atlanta, I was really excited to have this open up. It felt really good to walk into a store and know that I could ask about whatever spell, whatever intimate magical thing that might be going on in my mind, and know that I could get a good response from it.
I'm Orion Crook, and I was raised in Miami, Florida. But in this case in particular is two of my wands that I made. So these are built with copper, and inside of them there's actually these glass vials, and they come with a candle that goes right in the top. So I've been making wands, you know, for years, over 10 years. My mother raised me in this way that was, you know, this is how you create your altar, this is how you wash your crystals. So I was just kind of raised as a witch without ever knowing that.
That's just like,
yeah, it's very much like Buddhism.
I'm Paul Lawrence. I'm from Atlanta, right down the street. I mean, up in Asheville, in North Carolina and stuff, they have plenty of stuff like this. But I don't know if I've seen one in Atlanta before.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the first in Atlanta. I'm Lindsay Green, and I am from Marietta. I don't know much about witchcraft. Now I do, I guess, a little bit.
Good to meet you. Lovely to meet
you. That piece was produced by GPB intern Olivia Reingold. Head to gpbnews.org to learn more and see pictures from the news store. Do you believe in magic? Before we launch into our next discussion, a quick disclaimer. You heard about witchcraft just now, and we're going to talk about the Satanic Temple, but we are not drawing comparisons between the two. They are not related in beliefs or principles. Okay, end disclaimer. The Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple wants to host an after-school program for kids in Cobb County, and that is, not surprisingly, causing a little controversy. Fred Mephisto heads the Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple. Hi there.
Hello.
Is Mephisto your actual last name?
No, it is not. due to good sense, I use a pseudonym and not my actual name. That keeps the bricks through the window down.
So there is this accusation that members of the Satanic Temple aren't Satanists at all, but are mostly atheists who are trying to fight for separation of church and state. How accurate is that?
Well, I don't think that it's mutually exclusive categorizations there. We are certainly an activism group for separation of church and state. However, I don't think that invalidates us as a religion. Certainly, our tenets are deeply held personal beliefs. You know, we consider ourselves a non-theistic religion in that we don't believe in a deity or deities, we don't find a need to explain the universe with supernatural explanations. But nevertheless, we certainly feel that we qualify legally and conceptually as a religion. That said, we certainly think that we can be a religion as well as advocate for separation of church and state issues.
So let me read the Satanic Temple's mission statement here. Quote, "The mission of the Satanic Temple is to encourage benevolence and empathy among all people, reject tyrannical authority, advocate practical common sense and justice, and be directed by the human conscience to undertake noble pursuits guided by the individual will." Now, how does an after-school program fit into that mission statement?
Well, we believe that the existence of Christian and evangelical after-school programs is, first of all, a violation of separation of church and state. Now, that's predicated on 2001 Supreme Court decision of Good News Club versus Milford Central School. But our position is that there really should be a more fundamental and total separation of church and state. Now, given that that is already not the case, it's in our part of our mission to provide an alternative to the existing clubs, whereas there currently is no alternative. we don't feel as though that it's the prerogative of religion to be able to proselytize in the public domain like that, especially at a public school.
Okay, so here's a little clip of a report from WSB-TV on this controversy.
As some describe the Satanic Temple as a group of political activists, and their main priority, the separation of church and state. But parents who send their kids to school here that we talk to really don't like that name, regardless of what the group says it means.
So, okay, oftentimes in other states, the Satanic Temple has sued schools that include Christian programs and sued.
We've yet to actually file a lawsuit.
The Satanic Temple?
We have not, on this issue, we have not filed any lawsuits. We're kind of developing our strategy for that right now, but so far, in some cases...
On the issue of after-school programs.
Correct. There have been other lawsuits, right, such as the Baphomet Monument in Oklahoma with the Ten Commandments Monument and things like that. But
right,
we haven't actually filed any suits on
very,
that.
And what I'm trying to say is that in other cases with lawsuits, the thing that has, in the end, this name that parents find objectionable has often been what made the lawsuit successful. In other words, the law protects all religions.
Correct.
And allows equal access for all religions.
Correct.
Meaning that if you have
the ones you don't like.
Right. So if you have the Ten Commandments monument up, the Satanic Temple says, well, then we want to put up our statue of Baphomet.
Exactly. I mean, we're just trying to, we show up when the law does not seem to be applied evenly or correctly. And that only one organization has applied for a Ten Commandments monument is oftentimes used as an excuse to allow only that monument. However, once we file an application, you can no longer say, well, there is nobody else actually desiring to put up a monument and so forth. So we kind of put it to the test. You know, we put the religious equality question to the test by showing up and trying to follow an exact replication of the steps followed by other groups, their application process for the after-school club, for the monument, and so forth. We just try and copy what they do and see if they are actually applying separation of church and state, or not even separation of church and state, equal representation by the Establishment Clause in public domain.
So the National Satanic Temple Organization also even created a coloring book, a satanic coloring book for kids to offer because they had had a Bible coloring book at a school in Florida.
Right, absolutely. When they were handing out religious indoctrination materials at an elementary school, we simply just generated a very, you know, it's not proselytizing our materials.
No, it's actually pretty.
Yeah, I mean the only
I read
reason,
through the whole thing. There's nothing objectionable.
The
in
only
there,
reason someone could not like it is if you don't like the word Satan. You know,
right.
There's very little, and the same applies to our after school curriculum. There's nothing that a sensible person can find objectionable in there, as long as just the simple name of our organization isn't found to be objectionable in itself.
Well, many people find that objectionable.
Sure, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Fred Mephisto. He's the Atlanta chapter head for the Satanic Temple, and we're talking about the effort to get a after school program led by the Satanic Temple in Cobb County schools. And you were beginning to talk about the curriculum. So what is in the curriculum
for
the after school?
At this point, we haven't published the curriculum outside of areas that are actually holding the club, partly because other similar organizations have not been asked to show their curriculum in advance of getting the application. So we keep that fairly, you know, under tight wraps just to follow the process that has been set forth by other organizations. They haven't been asked to show their curriculum before they are approved, so we kind of keep that a little bit of a guarded secret. That said, if you were to read it, I mean, it's very straight to the point in terms of critical thinking, community involvement, secular morality, and things to that effect, you know, scientific rationalism. We're certainly not teaching children how to worship Satan. We don't even believe in Satan. There's no indoctrination or proselytization. We're really just trying to offer a very secular, morality-oriented alternative to the evangelical clubs, which already exists in the places we've applied.
Without giving anything away, I wonder if it's similar to the coloring book
it's,
we referenced.
It's
you know,
be
there
similar.
Was a word search in the activity book that was we were looking for words like friends and
yeah,
love and happiness and acceptance.
And there's lessons about not bullying, and they actually, rather than you know, censure the bully kid, they kind of educate him through the process of the coloring book, you know, how he ought to be more friendly to everyone. So, I mean, it's pretty wholesome stuff, really, when you get down to it.
Do you have kids?
I do not have kids.
Do other members of the Satanic Temple
other members
have kids?
Of the Satanic Temple definitely have kids.
And did they contribute to the thoughts on this after-school program?
Sure. We have parents who are members of the chapter, members of the national organization, you know, there's people in Cobb County who are interested and involved. So, you know, we certainly include parents in our membership.
All right. So then what has the effort been? If your point was to try and see if there was equal access for all religions to these kind of programs, has that turned out so far to be true?
So far, that hasn't been the case. Now, since applying in, I believe, the beginning of August, we have communicated a little back and forth with Cobb County, but we really haven't received a meaningful response to the application itself. We've gone back about a little bit of kind of procedural stuff and some questions like what's the address of our organization and so forth. But really, as far as any actual answers, yes or no, can we hold the club? We really haven't heard any word. And, you know, 6 months certainly seems like plenty of time for that kind of extreme low-level decision to be made by the Cobb County School Board. It's my belief that they are just stalling and kind of calling our bluff and waiting to see if we're going to follow through. And, you know, to their credit, so far that's working in that we haven't actually held the club. But we consider that a de facto denial of our application, which, you know, we think is the grounds for a religious discrimination lawsuit.
And are you prepared? I mean, that's what they
definitely are prepared. I mean, I nobody more so than me. However, unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer. So I do depend on sort of the good advice and the timing of our legal defense groups, such as Americans United for Separation of Church and State. They're heavily involved, ACLU to some degree. So these guys, you know, I mean, I can't, you know, snap my fingers and have them act on my behalf at any moment. But, you know, things are in the works and we're kind of planning our strategy here. There's several other cities in which similar treatment has been given to the application, and we're kind of crafting our strategy, which is inclusive of all of those other cities as well. So it may not be Atlanta that's a lawsuit is filed initially, because we want to try and set a precedent without spending so much resources and filing in multiple cities. But like I say, I mean, from our point of view, we're kind of just waiting on our legal defense guys to get to us on their long list since the recent election.
Do you have any idea how long it took other Christian organizations to get their after-school activities approved?
I guess I don't have an exact number I can give you on that, but if it took 6 months, I would be shocked.
What if the Cobb County Schools comes to you tomorrow and says, okay, this is approved, the Satanic Temple can do an after-school activity, are you prepared to do
that? Yeah. I mean, you know, when we first applied for the facility use, I mean, we were ready to go that afternoon, you know. 6 months of kind of attrition, we're just sort of waiting, and I'd have to kind of rally the troops again. But, I mean, we're fundamentally ready to go at any moment. You know, we've got our materials in hand. I've got volunteer, background check volunteers, most of whom have an education background and things like that. So, you know, we're kind of just waiting for the green light and have been for a while.
Do you say, I mean, I've looked at a lot of the material from the Satanic Temple, and as you say, it doesn't proselytize. There's nothing in there telling people to worship Satan. But does the Satanic Temple hold services?
I think services would be putting it a little strongly. I mean, we, you know, I mean, I think like most people, I mean, we enjoy ceremony and doing a ritual, not unlike other religions. But we're right now, I don't, as the chapter head of Atlanta Group, don't really have, you know, a headquarters or a you know, a church that we can do things out of. I mean, we get together and we do community service activities and things like that, but, you know, we don't really have a regular Sunday service type of situation. I mean, not that we wouldn't, but, you know, with our lack of belief in the supernatural, you know, ritual takes on somewhat of a different meaning, and it's more of a community building exercise and a social activity.
So you are, you guys have been around, this particular chapter has been around for about a year, you said.
Correct.
This has to be, to some extent, an uphill battle. I'm making that assumption. You're in Georgia.
It is. But, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that initially attracted me to the Satanic Temple itself is that we try not to fight meaningless and unwinnable battles. You know, we try and select our issues based on things which are, in our opinion, clearly expressed by the law, you know, issues of separation, church and state, and go about it in meaningful ways that hopefully can predicate a change. You know, I mean, we like to take the activism a lot further than holding up cardboard signs in the rain, you know. And so, you know, although it is an uphill battle, on the other hand, it just seems the law is so clear that eventually we're sure to prevail.
Is that, I mean, the Satanic Temple, we have about a minute left, but the Satanic Temple has been remarkably successful in the lawsuits and fights it's fought in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have teeth. We're prepared to back our actions up with, you know, application of the law based on legal action.
And do you think that's why? Because you choose, you're careful in selecting
battles
that are winnable?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're not just out there to tackle any old issue which happens to take, you know, our attention. We're really specially focused and designed around particular separation of church and state types of issues, which are almost always you know, have a precedent with some other group. You know, I mean, we're trying to follow suit. In most of our actions, we're trying to follow suit with something that already exists and try and point out the discrepancy. Now, like, again, with the After School Satan Club, it sounds, you know, a lot of people will think that our main mission is to actually hold that club. In fact, a better victory for us would be for them to suspend the other clubs. That would actually be our top priority.
And have zero religious
Exactly. That separation of church and state should be applied. And a second best alternative is that we are be allowed to hold our club as an alternative, because there is currently no alternative.
Fred Mephisto is the chapter head for the Atlanta chapter of the Satanic Temple. Fred, thank you so much.
Thank you. Hail Satan.
Just ahead, your life as the Old Testament, as told by actor Stephen Tobolowsky. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We hope you'll join us tomorrow as we spend the hour talking about democracy. We'll revisit a conversation with Andrew Young and talk about whether the democratic process is doomed to fail in the United States. And we'd love you to join that conversation. Does democracy work long term? What are the shining examples of that or failures? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning. Actor Stephen Tobolowsky has appeared in more than 100 films and 200 TV shows. You might remember him from the classic 1993 film Groundhog Day.
Ned Ryerson! Needle Nose Ned, Ned the Head. Come on, buddy. Case Western High. Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show. Bing!
But now Stephen is busy putting his memories on the page. His new book is My Adventures with God. And it explores not only his own childhood, but also his continuing and evolving relationship with the divine. Stephen Tobolowsky joins me now. Hi there.
Hey, good morning.
So I wonder, is this a memoir? Was it intended to be a memoir?
Well, yeah. It kind of the short, long elevator version of this is that in, what was it, 2008, I had a terrible, terrible accident in that I broke my neck riding a horse on the side of an active volcano in Iceland. Like, no joke. Like, what could possibly have gone wrong? So I come back to America. My doctor told me that I had a fatal injury. I'd broken five of my vertebrae, and the middle vertebra was crushed. And you don't like to hear your doctor say you had a fatal injury, especially when you're alive. It's a misuse of the word fatal, I would say.
Right.
But anyway, when you can't do anything with a broken neck, I thought, what if what the doctor said was true? And what if I died on that mountain? What would I have wanted my boys, my two kids, to know about their dad? And so, because I couldn't do anything else, I started writing these stories, true stories about my life that I wanted my boys to know about their father. First love, first job, first heartache, first adversary, that kind of thing. Those stories ended up as the Tobolowsky files on the internet, which became radio shows all over the country. And Simon and Schuster said, can we do stories, a book of these stories, which ended up being the Dangerous Animals Club. And after my first book of stories came out, the Dangerous Animals Club, I get a call from my editor, and he said, you know, there's a real spiritual bent to your stories. Can you write a book about spirit and the evolution of faith? And of course, I said, yes, without having any idea what I would possibly write. But if someone says, will you write a book? You go, well, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And what I figured out was this, is the reason it's so difficult to talk about God and about faith is that there's no real definition. Nothing comes to mind. I mean, we depend on nouns to get through the day. And with God, it changes so much throughout our life, from a baby to a young person in college, to having children of your own, to losing loved ones, to being my age now. Different things happen to you that shape, you know, so many of us are shaped by the invisible, however you want to define it. Our life is not a matter of, a lot of times I think we like to think that we take old questions and turn them into new certainties. But really what happens in life is we take old certainties and we turn them into new questions. And so what happens is we use the invisible in some way or another to give us guidance. And so I continued the stories from Dangerous Animals Club and how this thing, this invisible in my life, which I call God, which I do feel is divine and which I do feel is wisdom and goodness, and how that has kind of shaped my life. And the template I came up with the book, and most of these stories are funny. I know it's very dryly funny. Yes, it's strange talking about God and saying, well, the stories are meant to be amusing. But everybody's life, I think, kind of falls into the template of the Old Testament.
This is the Pentateuch.
What I told the people at Simon & Schuster to sell the idea, is that we all have a Genesis, and these are the stories we usually tell other people on a first date with a first glass of Chardonnay.
Where are you from? Where were you born? What do your parents
that
do?
That thing.
And I want to be clear, because your book, I guess, intentionally followed the Pentateuch, and that's the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
That's right.
Go again, you start out with Genesis, which, as you say, is like your basic bio.
Genesis stories, and you know how God could have even been the old man in the clouds then, but it's about what I loved about the woods and what I loved in my family and going to Sunday school, etc. And then we all go into slavery, like in Exodus, and
high
school. Oh God, we lose we see God. Like for me, I ended up seeing God in my girlfriend's eyes in college. And that was during the Vietnam War. And a lot of my friends lost themselves in the slavery of like alcohol or drugs. And then there's terrible first jobs and heartbreak and not being able to see opportunity. And inevitably, we get out of slavery. And like in the Bible, we find we're still lost in the wilderness. And then we have a Leviticus moment. In the middle of our life, where we stand up and we say to no one in particular, hey, wait a minute, this is what I am. And this is when I got married. So I have stories about meeting my wife. Mm-hmm. This is when I had children. This is about me becoming a father. These stories happen in the and I return to Judaism. And I meet an old rabbi who I have a very good relationship with, a learning relationship. It changed my life. And then, like in the book of Numbers, we're shaped by mortality. I lost my mother and people close to me. And so I have stories of how mortality shaped me in that section of the book. And then finally, Deuteronomy, drum roll, this is when we tell our stories to our children, like Moses told the stories to the children of Israel, because, hey, they forgot what they were doing. They were wandering in the desert for 39 years, and they didn't even know what their own story was. So I have stories about my children in Deuteronomy. And that's kind of the shape of the book.
And in Israeli, in Jewish tradition, Moses is believed to have written those first five books. And you point out that he never actually reached the Promised Land. He got them all the way in that one book, and then it stopped until the next story.
Yeah, well, it stopped until Joshua. That's I always talk to my friends, and they say, well, what's the story of the Bible? Well, it's Moses going to the Promised Land. Yeah, but he doesn't get there. It's the greatest cliffhanger ever invented. You know, he dies on the mountain looking at it, and the entire Jewish nation is outside the Holy Land, and that's where it ends. And then in Judaism, you start reading the thing all over again. So it goes round and round and round as we seek to find that beautiful place that we want to end up.
So, you know, I got the book less than a week ago, so I haven't mm-hmm. made it through to your return to Judaism. I'm still going through. I went through your childhood. I got through some fairly hedonistic days in Hollywood.
Oh, dear.
But I will say that a lot of the relationship with God seems to be limbed for you In fears, especially getting over childish fears. And you know, you start with sort of the dangerous animals, which in your case seems to be a lot of water moccasins. But you also have these fears that you're both attracted to and repel you. The fact that you love horror movies and yet you have the monster that lives in your room for the first whatever how many years of your life, and you're not sure whether to be afraid of it.
He's still there occasionally.
Right. So where do you come to in terms of fear of God and how that affects our relationship with the divine?
It's interesting. You know, in Judaism, Hebrew doesn't have a lot of words, but the words have many, many meanings, and it's kind of deep. And one word that everybody kind of knows from TV shows is shalom. Like, hey, shalom. You know, it means peace. It means hello. It kind of means, yeah, goodbye or whatever. But there's another meaning to the word shalom, too, and that is complete. It is to be complete is shalom. And what I would say, my theory is that we don't look for happiness in life. There's hardly any other way to explain all the self-destructive behavior we have. And as you say, the fear in our life that we're both attracted to and repelled by, I think what we look for in life is to feel complete. And there are different ways to feel complete. One of them is with fear, because you know when that fear button is touched, you are whole and you start running. The fight or flight happens and you run. So I think we are attracted to fear. And that's another reason why, like, alcohol and drugs get a hold of us, because it is certainly not our better selves. But when you're loaded, you feel complete. And so that's what I think we search for, is completeness. And that's why I think God is important, because it gives us... When God comes in the manifestation of wisdom or kindness or love, we get completeness that way, and it makes our lives so much happier than if our lives are complete with fear or with rage or with something else.
So the other, besides you, the other main character I thought in the book, at least so far, is your mom. And she's also the source of a lot of the humor. I'm thinking of the phrase she used to use whenever anybody got their heart broken. Then the green stamps that she would award you. What was it like for you to go back and sort of revisit your memories of your mom?
I got to tell you, you know, it's the other day I got a job. And, you know, as an actor, that's what I do most of the time to support my career as a writer. Oh, gosh. Talk about blind leading the blind. But I called up my father, who's 95 now, and I was so excited. I wanted to tell him about the job, and the words were coming out my mouth. Oh, is Mom there? I wanted to tell her about it, and she's been gone now since 2005. She's been gone now for over 10 years, and she's still so present to me, and I still miss her so much. And it's the same with my brother and my sister. And when I visit Dad in Dallas, it's the same too. When she was a unique person, a person that loved being a mother and loved us as children. And we were lucky that way, in that we grew up in a household of love. And I'm not going to do spoilers for the book, because you are in an area that there are callbacks in the later stories to the book to some of the earlier stories that are kind of surprising. So I'm going to kind of leave those alone. But my mother made an impact on so many people, because she was almost the personification of love in a very goofy way. I don't understand how her mind worked. I don't understand. I mean, like the whole thing of us kids being Jewish but celebrating Christmas.
Yeah, but she put the presents under the table.
under the dining room table. And the reason she gave us was, first of all, she said we were Jewish, so we could not have a Christmas tree for some reason, even though it's kind of a pagan symbol of Christmas. But we couldn't have a Christmas tree, but Santa said we could have the presents under the dining room table.
But you didn't have a chimney.
We didn't have a chimney. Santa was going to use the back door. And all this troubled me very much. And I asked Mom, I said, well, why? Why does Santa put the presents under the dining room table? And she said, well, because Santa doesn't want you to be different from other children. He wants you to be able to get your presents from under something like everybody else. And I'm like 5 years old. I said, Mom, we're still different from everybody else. No one else gets their presents under a dining room table. And when people get their presents under the Christmas tree, they're not under the Christmas tree. They're around the Christmas tree. And she would always look into space and say, well, steppy doors, I don't know. I wrote Santa a letter, and I told him about that we were Jewish, and he said that he would just use the back door and put the presents under the dining room table. You'd have to talk to Santa about that.
And there's a great picture of you giving Santa kind of a skeptical look. Remained unconvinced by the guy in the red suit.
but that's kind of the first way we do encounter God. When you think about it, the metaphor of Saint Nick is this figure that is sort of eternal and sort of beyond us, who gives out joy and largesse to the world, to the entire world in a miraculous way. And we grab on to that Santa metaphor until our faith is broken. And I think part of what I was calling the invisible arc of faith throughout our life is loss of faith. I think our loss of faith and doubt is very important. And I have a lot of dear, dear, dear atheist friends, and they view religion as something that's filled with certainty and an elimination of doubt. And everybody I know that is a person of faith, they're filled with doubt. And that's what I loved about some of the great Jewish books I read, like the Talmud and the Mishnah and things like that, is that faith is supposed to give you doubt. Thoughts of God are supposed to create doubt, because it's in that gap between what we know and what we don't, in that chasm, is where we make a leap. And it's in that leap that we find prayer, and we find blessings, and we find kindness, and we could even find wisdom. It's in the leap and not necessarily where we stand today, where we stand this morning.
That is actor Stephen Tobolowsky. His new book is called My Adventures with God. It hit shelves April 18th. You can also see him at the Marcus Jewish Community Center in Atlanta for a book signing on May 4th. Stephen, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for this.
And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your comments. Tell us about your faith, if you have one. Have you ever had doubts? Has your faith ever changed? Call us at 404-500-9457 or post on Facebook or Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.